Jack Muir is my guest today. He is a 2015 John Monash Scholar. He's currently studying geophysics at Caltech University as part of his PhD studies. Jack is an expert in seismic waves, and part of that is trying to predict the size and scale of earthquakes. G'day, Jack. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm terrific. Tell us about what you are studying.
So I'm studying how we can use seismic waves, which are basically sound waves propagating through the solid earth, to understand what sort of structures are in the ground beneath us. So basically, it's quite similar to if you were to take an ultrasound of any of your organs, if you're in a health checkup. You send sound waves into the human body and they reflect off things, they come back, you record them, and with a lot of fancy mathematics, you can turn that into an image. What I do is basically similar to that, but we use sources like earthquakes or energy that's been generated by the wind and waves or human activities. And then we record them using seismometers on the Earth's surface. And we try to do the same sort of things that medical practitioners do with their technology. Of course, with the Earth, because we don't have control over what the input is and we only have very sparse output, it's sort of like trying to take a picture with most of the pixels missing on your sensor. So images are a lot worse than what you get out from medical technology, but that's what we're sort of aspiring to get at. And you need to utilize your knowledge of the Earth to try to get better pictures, basically, of what we're looking at. And the sort of things that we're trying to take images of range in scale from, say, the very near surface, so trying to understand how strong the ground is beneath a new building that's going up. So that's okay. Geotechnical surveys. Yeah. That's really important, you know. Think of the buildings that have sort of cracked in Homebush in Sydney due to inadequate assessment of the ground underneath them, to say a basin scale. So I have been working in LA for most of the last 5.5 years. And in that area, we're looking at the whole city is built on a big mass of very loose soil, and that typically amplifies the damage from earthquakes. So trying to understand the shape of that basin is really important for predicting that. And then we go to really big scales, so looking at the whole Earth, and then we're looking at how we can answer really fundamental questions about why the Earth supports life, why the climate cycle is relatively constant over hundreds of millions of years. So really big scientific questions like that all rely on seismic imaging to give us at least part of the answer that we need.
Amazing. LA is built on a fault line, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's built on a lot more than one fault line. So what's happening there is actually the North America and Pacific are moving relative to each other. So the ground underneath the Pacific Ocean, and LA is really caught right in the middle between those two sort of blocks of relatively solid ground. And it's actually in a kink of this process. So they're sort of shifting what we call strike slip motion relative to each other. So they're sliding against each other. But where LA sits, there's a bend in this sliding. And so you actually get not only the sliding, but also compression, because the bend is sort of, you can imagine if you've got you could try to move two things against each other, but then there's a little kink in between, you're actually then pressing up. And so that throws up these amazing mountains that are behind LA, the San Gabriels. That are really beautiful, but also it means that inside the basin there's all these thrust faults, which are very dangerous because you can't see them at the surface because the whole area has been covered with sediments, basically, as the mountains have grown up. But they rupture every 10,000 years or so. You don't really know where they've come from. And then they'll suddenly produce a relatively decently sized earthquake right underneath the city. So that's very dangerous. And then, of course, you also have the famous San Andreas Fault that is the big fault in the area. That's a little bit further away from LA, so it's a different sort of danger.
Where's that?
Yeah, so it runs basically behind the San Gabriels in LA. It runs past Palm Springs to the south, so past the Salton Sea, down into the Gulf of California. And then it goes up inside the coastline of California and sort of exits out into the ocean just north of San Francisco. So it was very close to San Francisco, which is why they are particularly worried about the San Andreas there. And that's why they had this devastating 1906 earthquake, which really kicked off earthquake science in North America as a field.
Well, they're always predicting the next big one, aren't they? Or trying to, saying it's coming, it's close.
Yeah, of course. So the party line at Caltech, which I do adhere to, is that it's impossible to predict when the big one will happen. We just know that it will happen. It happens roughly, if I remember correctly, every 250 to 300 years or so on average.
Yes.
But that is a very loose average. And actually, you have timescales ranging from, the maximum recorded time in the recent past is, I think, 1,000-year gap. And the minimum is a 50-year gap. So it really is very variable. And you can't predict with good accuracy when these large earthquakes will happen. But thankfully, we do sort of understand roughly how big the big one is likely to be.
Okay.
And what sort of damages it would produce. And so you can design, say, the building codes in LA around that understanding and plan for emergency management response, which is a really important field that I'm definitely not an expert in, but something that people are really actively working on in California, in New Zealand, in Japan. They really have it very advanced because they have so many earthquakes in Japan. That's a really big part of the field as well.
What about in Australia? Do we have many here?
We have some small earthquakes on the East Coast where most people live. So I know recently both Canberra and Melbourne have felt. There was one in Jindabyne just recently. Those aren't really super damaging. We, of course, had the Newcastle earthquake, which I believe was in 1987. And that really shows, it was a relatively small earthquake, but quite shallow. And also combined with the fact that Australia doesn't really have any kind of serious earthquake building code, it caused really serious damage. And we also have these large intraplate earthquakes in the middle of Australia that are really hard to understand. And they can be surprisingly big, actually. And it's just sort of random chance, as far as we know, where they occur. And so if they were to occur underneath a town, then you can get very serious damage. I know that's happened in towns in Western Australia.
Mm.
As well in, I think, the 1950s, if I recall correctly, but I would need to look that up again.
So what are some of the practical applications of your field of work, of your study? Once you get through it, you say, well, I can help in this area. I can assist in that area. You've already mentioned building codes, but like what else can you do?
Yeah, so there's a really wide variety of things that geophysical imaging is used for. So on the sort of understanding hazard space, there's obviously trying to understand what sort of building codes we need and what the emergency management responses should be. There's the insurance aspect. So insurance companies really want to know what their sort of risk portfolio is. So that's very important. And then it goes further towards the commercial exploitation of earth resources. So seismic imaging is obviously used to understand, what sort of things are in the ground that we might potentially make use of. So in Australia, that's potentially geothermal energy. Lots of people talk about carbon capture and storage. You can debate whether or not that's actually going to be a viable technology economically, but we can certainly identify areas which are potentially prospects for carbon capture and storage. Ore bodies are a big topic at the moment. So Geoscience Australia is doing a huge survey of the interior of Australia, trying to figure out where buried ore bodies might be in the desert, where they haven't expressed themselves at the surface, but we might be able to sense them seismically and then dig them up if that's potentially commercially viable. And then, of course, the really big one, which has driven a huge amount of progress in seismology, seismic imaging, has in the oil and gas industry, although that's not as big in Australia, but in the US, that's certainly a huge driver. Trying to understand where oil and gas resources might be.
Where the good stuff's hiding.
Yeah. And then the last big topic, I guess, which I should point out, which was very important for the understanding of earthquake source process or just how seismic waves propagate in general, especially in the middle of the 20th century, was that seismology is sort of the frontline defense in nuclear test monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
So especially when people moved nuclear tests underground and prior to the establishment of detailed satellite imaging, although it's still very important today as well, you would measure people's illicit nuclear tests on seismographs and then try to understand where they were and how big they are. And that, for instance, is something that's still very actively done with North Korea, trying to understand how large they can potentially make their nuclear weapons based on the testing that they're doing. So you can't really see anything since they dig it under, they set their tests up underneath a big mountain, basically.
Right.
So that you can't spy it from space, but they can't hide the fact that, that generates seismic energy. And you can record that and then try to infer how big the yield is of these weapons that they're producing. So that's still really important. And that was a huge driver in the 50s and 60s, especially for seismology.
And you've done some work with the Australian Nuclear Science and Technology Organisation, haven't you?
I have, but it was totally unrelated to earth science.
Okay.
So I started off my undergrad as a math/physics major. So I was very interested in sort of physics as white lab coats and lasers and that sort of good stuff. And I was enjoying that, and I decided that I would take this year off to do it. It's called a year in industry internship program at ANSTO. I think they still do it, and it's a great program where you go and you work for a year at ANSTO and do some research with the staff scientists there.
Is that in Sydney?
In Lucas Heights, yeah.
Yes. Yep.
And I had a great time doing it, but I realized that I did not make a very good experimental physicist. So I'm very grateful that year taught me that I like research, but not that research in particular.
That's often the good thing, isn't it? You do something and to realize that that's not something you want to do long term.
Yeah, of course. And I think it was really an incredibly valuable experience to have. It's pretty rare in Australia that you get to have these long, intensive research experiences before. A PhD is a long commitment. Even in an honours year in Australia, you're only really doing research, say, 50% of the time. And so the opportunity to do 100% research for a whole year prior to starting a PhD, it was a really incredible opportunity. So I'm very grateful towards ANSTO for giving me that opportunity, and hopefully they got something out of it as well.
So, Jack, what was it that first sparked your interest in this field of study? Because, I can't imagine there would be a lot of people diving into what you've chosen to study. So what was it that made you interested?
Yeah, so I grew up in the sort of hinterlands north of Sydney, so specifically Mangrove Creek, which is due west of Gosford. And it's this really spectacular, feels very ancient part of Australia, although actually it turns out, geologically speaking, it's relatively young compared to most of Australia. Yeah. And it just has this incredible diversity of wildlife, weather systems. It's just a really spectacular place to live. So I loved growing up there, and my parents really plied me with all sorts of science books. So, like those DK picture books that are pretty popular in school libraries and stuff like that.
Yes.
And I read all of them. I read Bill Bryson's Short History of Nearly Everything, I think, 3 or 4 times in the space of a couple of years when I was about 12. So all those things, I really enjoyed science, and also I was very competitive at school, so I enjoyed being first in all my classes. So I studied pretty hard, and winning all the mathematics classes and things like that. And so through that, I think I really just decided relatively early on that I wanted to do science as my career.
Okay.
And also, the school that I went to was very much like, The done thing was to be a doctor or a lawyer if you were doing well, and I didn't really feel like conforming to that that idea. So I moved out of Sydney, went down to the ANU to get away from everybody doing law degrees. Down to Canberra. And I started doing this very innovative undergraduate degree. It's called a Bachelor of Philosophy at the ANU, and the idea there is that it's a research-forward undergraduate degree, which is quite rare in Australia. So every semester you do research as part of your studies, and serious research. So I got publications out of the research that I did as an undergraduate.
What did you look into back then? Can you remember? Yeah,
all sorts of things. So I looked at the physics of plasmas. So that's basically really superheated gases that are so hot that the individual atoms basically break apart to a certain extent and become electrically charged. So that's with an eye to developing fusion energy as a sort of
Yes.
long-term
Okay.
renewable energy source. So ANU had a big plasma physics program, so I did some experimental physics there. I did some quantum optics, so that's trying to understand in that particular project how you could turn very sensitive instruments into basically seismometers in the end, actually. So it turns out I've sort of come round in a circle on that project. I did some astronomy. That's sort of how I actually fell into geophysics in the end, was via the astronomy path. So I did astronomy, which I call like an observational science. So you have data that comes in and you can't really like do experiments per se, because you can't do an experiment on a star. But you can
Very
observe them and
hard. Yeah.
try to, like understand what's happening through your observations and modeling and theory. And geophysics is sort of very philosophically aligned with astronomy. And historically, there were really like people were both astronomers and geophysicists, especially in the early 20th century. They often flipped back and forth between the two fields.
Okay.
And so I was like, well, I enjoyed astronomy, but I also had these great memories of growing up and being outside. And I thought geophysics was a great way to combine these two sort
It's a
of
nice
aspects of
mix.
my life.
And so how did the scholarship come about and your journey across to California?
So the scholarship, I've been trying to remember exactly how I found out about it. And if I can recall, I think what happened was that I was at Bergman College, Res Hall, in ANU, and one of the earlier scholars, Phoebe Downing, had a younger brother who was in my year at the college, and I think he mentioned it to me that she had recently gotten this award, and I think she went off to Oxford with it. And that was something that was worth considering if you wanted to study overseas. And then I also found out that my old debating coach from high school had received one
Really? And
subsequently.
you thought, what's this all
So
about? Hang on, I'll look into this.
I looked into it and I thought I would apply. And I really liked the foundations philosophy. So the fact that there was this diversity of the cohort was fantastic. They were trying to push that more, I felt, than the other more traditional scholarships. The fact that it was to go anywhere overseas, I thought was really
Yes.
important, because the
Yep.
fact that Australia has sort of this obsession with the traditional English universities was sort of a limiting factor, I thought, of many of the other
Yep.
fellowships. And that they would support me to do basically whatever I wanted was great. So I thought, yeah, I'd give it a
Within
shot. Within
reason.
reason, yeah. Anything that's societally
Yes.
useful.
Yes.
Evidently, they thought what I was pitching was worthy of support.
Yes.
And so I applied and went through the process of doing all the interviews that were really quite fun, actually. And then I got it, and it was a great opportunity. And I said that I was going to go to Caltech in my application, and I applied for Caltech and then a bunch of different other US schools as well. And in the end, I visited all the ones that I got into, and I decided that, yeah, Caltech was the right place for this, because it's such an amazing institute for earthquake science.
Yeah, I was going to ask. So what was the main reason why you picked that institution as opposed to any other?
So Caltech is very collegial with its students and faculty. So every student has to start with basically two very distinct research projects, with two different faculty members supervising them. And then you do those, and then you sort of have a lot of freedom thereafter to basically do whatever research you want, especially if you have external research funding, like I was lucky enough to have with the John Monash Scholarship, because then you're not tied to a particular grant that the PIA themselves has. And so I think nowhere else really had this really like collaborative relationship between senior faculty members and the graduate students. And I think it was really incredibly productive, and people got this amazing research done and continue to do amazing research at Caltech as a result. So it's just a really spectacular place to do your research as an early career scientist. And students from Caltech and postdocs from Caltech have historically gone on to have very, very successful careers as a result. So it's been a great opportunity, I think.
Did you work over there as well?
No. So part of the, like, US PhD students are really expected, because you do get some stipend support. Yeah. So you're expected to commit yourself pretty much to doing your work, especially in STEM fields. So anything that's science or engineering related, then you're not really expected to work. And honestly, especially in the early years, there's too much going on to really be able to do any work in addition to that.
but as I understand it, Jack, you've now moved back home to Australia and you're in Canberra finishing off your studies. Is that right?
Yeah, so I have a now 14-month-old daughter. So she was born in the first week of the COVID lockdown in California.
Wow.
Yeah, so she basically didn't really see anybody other than us without a mask on for 9 months.
Oh. Wow.
Which was a bit sad, and her grandparents never got to see her, and then we had some family medical issues as well. Yes. In Australia, and so basically a whole load of things came to a head altogether in September of last year, and we were like, no, this is too much, we're gonna head back home. And I was lucky enough that my supervisors at Caltech were happier for me to basically work remotely. I think it helped that everybody was working remotely at the time. And so I've been back in Australia since mid-December last year, and I moved down to, I got everything ready to move down to ANU in March. So I've been here since March, and it's been fantastic to be able to speak to people again. I mean, a lot of the people here are people who I knew from undergrad, and it's fantastic to work with them again and to be able to talk about science in person. So, yeah.
And how long have you got to go till you finish?
So I'm going to finish in October.
Fingers crossed.
And so I've got two papers left to publish, and they're sort of in 90% complete state at the moment. So not too much more to go, hopefully. And then I'm going to try to take the opportunity to do some work with the people at ANU. So work on some new projects here after that. And then in March... next year, I'm going to sound very hypocritical, bagging out UK institutions, because I'm going to head to Oxford for a couple of years.
There you
after
go.
That. So, yeah, I've been drawn in inexorably. I think something like 50% or more of John Monash scholars end up at Oxford at some point in their careers.
So what are you going to be doing over there?
So I'm really focusing on the earthquake hazard story at Oxford. So I'm going to be basically studying how we can use these recent developments in AI to make faster predictions for what seismic waves will look like. So basically, when you have this earthquake hazard story, you have the earthquake itself, and then that generates seismic waves, and the seismic waves propagate through the earth. And then they hit buildings. And the way they propagate is actually really important to understanding the sorts of damages that they can produce. There's like a really famous case in LA of the 1994 Northridge earthquake that happened. And basically, there were a lot of damage near the earthquake, obviously. And then there was like, you know, several tens of kilometers of not very much damage. Yes. And then suddenly down in downtown Santa Monica, there was like this zone where there were a bunch of buildings that were basically redlined. So condemned because they were too damaged. And people didn't really understand it because the building types weren't really significantly different from the other buildings nearby. So that's one thing you might think, you know, what if the buildings are bad, for whatever reason, but that wasn't the reason. But it turns out that there was basically effectively a lens in the earth underneath Santa Monica that had focused the energy. So even though it was, you know, weak nearby, that lens really caused like damaging shaking. In that specific area. And so that sort of, that understanding those sorts of hazards requires modeling the way seismic waves propagate from an earthquake out to where your buildings are. And that's an incredibly expensive supercomputer problem at the moment. So it uses, you know, they've done this for large parts of Southern California, like where the major faults are, running simulations to see how they would propagate to different areas. And I think they said it would take, you know, your bog standard laptop order of 100 million hours to compute the the details of that. So it's really not feasible to run that sort of information. Say if your model changes, you have to rerun it. So it's another 100 million hours. We need to have faster ways of doing this, basically. And so very recently, there've been a lot of progress in how to use the sorts of AI that, like, you know, Google and Facebook and stuff use to do language processing or image recognition to approximate the solutions much, much faster than doing the full solution. So you get, you know, 99% of the accuracy for 1% of the cost. And that's what I'm looking into doing. And I'll be working with the New Zealand's geophysicists, so GNS New Zealand's, to look at hazard in New Zealand, and also with people at Stanford to look at hazard in California as part of this project. So I think it'll be really exciting, this sort of global collaboration of areas that have high seismic hazard and understanding how we can use these new machine learning techniques to improve our estimates. So it'll be a good time.
So what do you, Jack, what do you like to do in your spare time? How do you relax? How do you chill out?
So obviously with a 14-month-old, that's a limited amount of time at the moment.
Yeah, hands full.
But so some of the things that I've been enjoying have been, I enjoy going hiking at the moment with her. So I've got like a hiking backpack for my daughter Hadley that I can put her in and go wandering around the hills around Canberra. So that's great fun. I've actually been recently learning the classical guitar. This is a very obscure sort of forward plan that I have, that Hadley will learn the violin or something like that, and it'd be nice to, you know, play with her something. And the traditional accompanying instrument is a, you know, a piano or something like that. But as an academic, I am destined to move around a lot, and lugging a piano around didn't seem very fun. So I was like, what's the next best instrument to try to play that's like a good accompanying instrument that's much more portable? And I found this classical guitar in my dad's basement, and I was like, maybe I can learn this. So I've been doing that for the last couple of weeks, and it's actually good fun. So
are you winning good enjoyable.
Well, I mean, I've been playing for less than a month, so no, I'm very bad. But it's coming along, so I'm learning a lot. I play bassoon to a much higher standard. Yeah. So we had a very funny incident when we all got our John Monash scholarships in 2015, that they thought it would be nice to have all the scholars who played instruments to play at the event. But of course, none of the people who were professional musicians said yes. There were actually, I think there was one person who was in our cohort who was a professional composer and could actually play, but he said no, probably wisely. And so it was just, you know, the people who were
weekend hackers.
People who just did it as a fun, you know, thing on the weekends. And thankfully they had three professionals from the Sydney Conservatorium also in the ensemble. We lent pretty heavily on their expertise. So there's a big difference between professional musos and amateurs in terms of their ability to cook up a performance at the last minute, for sure. So thankfully they were very professional, and it was a good time. But
fantastic. Well, it's been wonderful catching up with you today, Jack, and we wish you all the very best in the months ahead as you finish your PhD, and the next time there's some seismic rumblings around the world, I wonder if you'll be there with your instruments. So thank you for your time today, and we wish you well in the future. All the best.
Thanks so much.